Now, you want higher wages. Let me tell you what to do. Got to talk to the workers in the shop with you. You got to build you a union. Got to.
Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to Rock Review. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. For the next half hour, I shall be reading articles about rock and roll music from such sources as the News and Observer, The Week Magazine, Rolling Stone, and Entertainment Weekly.
Gone to heaven. St. Peter will be the straw boss then, boys.
Now you know you're this opening number, Talking Union, Pete Seeger. We'll be hearing more about and from Talking Blues later on in today's program. But first, these trivia questions.
Do something about it. Of course, the boss may persuade some poor damn fool to go to your meeting and act like a stool. But you can always tell a stool, though.
Our trivia questions come to us once again from www.funtrivia.com. Question number one. Who is best known for his three-finger picking of a five-string banjo? Is it answer A, Curly Joe Klein, B, Earl Scruggs, C, Doc Watson, D, Lester Flatt, or E, Steve Martin? Hint, this musician was born in Flint Hill, North Carolina on the 6th of June, 1924. Question number two. Not only men are famous in bluegrass, this lady is a talented fiddler and her lovely vocals were featured on the songs Down to the River to Pray, Didn't Leave Nobody But the Baby, and I'll Fly Away on the movie soundtrack of Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Was it A, Alison Krauss, B, Reba McEntire, C, June Carter Cash, D, Dolly Parton, or E, Lady Gaga? Hint, here's a snippet from the cover she did with Tony Furtado of the Beatles song I Will from their album Bluegrass Goes to Town. Who is that singer? The answers to these two important trivia questions will be given, as usual, at the end of today's program. The transition section of today's program, Today in Rock History, is brought to us once again by BGORecords.com. And today is the weekend of June the 3rd. What were the number one hits this weekend? Well, back in 1962, you may remember it was Mr. Acker Bilk and Stranger on the Shore at number one. Back in 1966, 4 years later, Rolling Stones, Paint It Black. Back in 1973, this weekend, it was Edgar Winter, Frankenstein at number one. Back in 1979, Blondie, Sunday Girl at number one. And back in 1983, The Police, Every Breath You Take at number one this weekend. If you were born on June the 3rd, you share a birthday with Levon Helm, the band. 1943, June the 3rd. Stevie Nicks, Fleetwood Mac, June the 3rd, 1948. And Lenny Kravitz, June the 3rd, 1964. Deaths on June the 3rd include Jimmy Rogers, country performer, 1933 on June the 3rd. And Little Willie John, the blues performer, died on June the 3rd, 1968. Or if you were born on June the 4th, you share a B-Day with Cliff Bennett, Rebel Rousers, 1940, June the 4th, Michelle Phillips of Mamas and the Papas, 1944, and Gordon Walker of Peter and Gordon, June the 4th, 1945. Miscellany in rock history this weekend. Well, back in 1932, Frankie Lane and partner Ruth Smith set the all-time marathon dancing record, lasting 3,501 hours, 145 consecutive days, earning him $600. And back in 1954, this weekend, it was the second annual National Hillbilly Music Festival and Jimmie Rodgers Memorial Day, held in Rodgers' hometown of Meridian, Mississippi. Back in 1958, this weekend, Jerry Lee Lewis plays his third and final show on what was to have been a 37-date UK tour. The London Evening Star calls him an undesirable alien. Back in 1962, this weekend, Willie Nelson hits the U.S. country chart for the first time with Touch Me. Back in 1977, this weekend, it was Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers' debut album hitting the charts. Back in 1992, this weekend, over 1 million people vote in a contest conducted by the U.S. Postal Service. The Young Elvis stamp design beats out the Vegas Elvis. And back in 1994, Michael Jackson marries Lisa Marie Presley. In local rock news, we see this editorial entitled Great Scotty, printed in the News and Observer on Friday, May 27, 2011. He's Opie Taylor with a big man's voice. He's a small-town kid close to his family who seemed perfectly at ease in the City of Angels. He's a churchgoer who plays baseball and favors plaid shirts and blue jeans, who'll now be covered in coat holders who buy his clothes and cater to his needs. He's a happy young man who today is trying to deal with being a national idol. And that's literal. Scotty McCreery, who a few months ago was playing his music in amateur shows close by his home in Garner, is now the latest American Idol, the winner in a blockbuster national talent show that concluded its latest version Wednesday night. He's one of ours.
You were always on my mind. You were always on my mind.
To say the region was excited would be a monumental understatement, evidenced by the appearance of over 8,000 people at Raleigh's RBC Center to watch the proceedings and cheer the kid on. The television sets in bars and places like the Alexander YMCA in Raleigh are normally set to sports events or news of sports events. Wednesday night, as the Idol decision was nearing, those sets were quietly tuned to the channel of decision. The News and Observer printed a special page and a section in celebration of victory. This young fellow has been good for Garner, good for the state. He's got a smile without a trace of phoniness in it, a self-effacing manner that's too natural to put on. He's the real deal, say those who's worked with him in local shows. Not a bit of the star syndrome about him. Now he'll face the biggest test, seeing whether he can make it in the country music business, a most competitive field. We bet he does. Nashville may underestimate him, what with his wholesome looks and his unaffected way, but then he's going to sing. This next article comes to us from the Wall Street Journal, published on May 21, 2011, by Raymond Tallis, Emeritus Professor of Geriatric Medicine at the University of Manchester, entitled Striking a False Note. This is, in effect, a review of the book by Elena Manis, The Power of Music, Pioneering Discoveries in the New Science of Song. Music is encoded in our brains and bodies, Elena Manis writes. It is easy to see the attraction of this idea, which goes back to at least the ancient Greeks. Claude Lévi-Strauss famously described music as the supreme mystery of human knowledge. All other branches of knowledge stumble into it, holds the key to their progress. More recently, the neuroscientist Robert Zattori has argued that music serves as a gateway into understanding human cognition. Ms. Maniz, an Emmy-winning granddaughter of the founders of New York's Maniz School of Music, is inspired by the possibility that neuroscience may help us harness the potential of music to treat the sick and even to build more harmonious communities. Yet her investigation, based on a PBS documentary that Ms. Maniz produced, gives us little reason to expect that neuroscience will deliver on this promissory note. The article skips down. Given that we are not in real life served up the various qualities of music independently, but experience them simultaneously, the experiments tell us little about the perception of sound, even less about the experience of music, and less still about the achievements of great music. The article skips down. Much of Ms. Maniz's argument rests on her claim that science has shown us that human beings are hardwired to enjoy music. The hardest wiring is supposed to be found in those oldest parts of the brain, such as the striatum, a part of the basal ganglia, that we share with other beasts. An entire chapter is therefore devoted to the musical tastes of whales, elephants that play drums, a dancing cockatoo, songbirds that enjoy the sound of a clarinet, and the ultrasound songs of courting mice. On the strength of this evidence, I don't think musicologists need worry that ethologists will encroach on their territory. Article skips down. The book's drift towards half-baked mysticism becomes worrying when Ms. Maniz discusses the therapeutic potential of music, how it may make people smarter, happier, and even healthier. While some studies show significant improvements in patients with neurological diseases when they listen to, or better, make music, this discovery hardly warrants Ms. Maniz's claim that music should be prescribed as if it were a supplement or alternative to pills. Ms. Maniz introduces us to one Vera Brandes, who has designated herself as the first musical pharmacologist and who sells music specially composed to address what she judges to be the patient's needs. Ms. Maniz is also excited by the next wave of treatments. These include devices that deliver vibrations to create physical resonance in the body, invented by a chiropractor who offers programs, methods, and products to the general public. She admits that this is not an area in which there are published scientific papers, but adds that the work is based on generally recognized scientific and medical fact, not, I would submit, a sound basis for selling cures to the ill or the worried well. This slide to Guru Goo makes an odd fit with the hard-line materialism of Ms. Maniz's opening chapters, which after all attempt to plant the effects of music in the physical brain. After introducing us to acoustic treatments such as hypnotic states induced by singing shamans, she concludes with this incongruous note of hope. Because of science, we will have a deeper understanding than ever before of how music can truly transform us. Judging from the conceptual muddles and scanty evidence in this naive book, I am confident that the mystery of music will remain intact for the foreseeable future, and its healing potential will be limited to those wonderful effects, profound emotions, experiences of beauty, joy, and admiration that don't require a clinic to deliver or pseudoscience to commend. So, what do you know about today's featured genre of music? Talkin' blues. Well, we happen to have in the studio today Mr. Bob Martin. Bob has agreed to read the role of musician, researcher, writer, producer, Stephen Wade, in this All Things Considered interview that took place back in March of 2001. This interview was transcribed from www.npr.org. Talking Blues is a song form that can trace its surface roots to a recording by the Greenville Trio in April of 1926. Its lineage goes much deeper to spirituals and an odd combination of the religious and the profane. The Talking Blues have served as a vehicle for social commentary for Woody Guthrie, Bob Dylan, and hundreds of others.
Fishing down on the muddy bank, I felt a pull and I give a big yank. I hauled out three old rubber boots and a Ford radiator and a Chevrolet coupe. Handed in for national defense. Sitting in a boat with a bucket of beer and I hadn't caught nothing, but I didn't much.
Woody Guthrie is one of the most recognizable voices in American folk music, and the Talking Blues is one of the most effective vehicles for social commentary. There are a few subjects that haven't been addressed through one Talking Blues or another. Stephen Wade, creator of the stage show Banjo Dancing, and a contributor to numerous folklore journals, traces the history of the Talking Blues. This musician and researcher says the form has a rich history in the folk tradition.
Go to sleep. Forget all about it.
In April of 1926, three brothers calling themselves the Greenville Tribune. In April 1926, three brothers calling themselves the Greenville Trio traveled to Atlanta from their home in South Carolina. In this, their second studio venture, Chris, Charlie, and Urs Bushalong recorded a number featuring Urs picking out a three-chord pattern on his guitar while Chris narrated the Talking Blues.
If you want to get to heaven, let me tell you how to do it. Grease your feet with a little mutton suet. Slide right out of the devil's hand and ooze right over in the promised land. Go easy. Make it easy. Go greasy. Stand in the corner by the mantelpiece, up in the corner by a bucket of grease. I grease my feet with a little axle grease when slipping up and down that mantelpiece hunting matches.
Chris Bushalong went on to record nearly two dozen titles, and he became known as the talking comedian of the South. Yet music for him remained essentially a part-time occupation. He worked in an iron foundry near his home, and later as a proprietor of a dry cleaner's. No researcher ever contacted him to ask him how he first heard the verses that comprised the Talking Blues, nor do historians know to what extent he set out to craft his own rendition. But within 3 years of its release, the Talking Blues had sold nearly 100,000 copies. Behind Chris Bushalong's hit song, not only a tradition of speech set to music, but an enduring comic framework.
With all my grip, eating hog eye. Love chitlins. Now, if you want to get in trouble, let me tell you how to do it. You get your guitar and then you're into it. You play all day and you play all night. Your folks say you never learn to play the thing right. Always fussing at you, griping, won't let you practice, trying to run you out to the hen house.
In Whitewash Station Blues, the Memphis Jug Band draws from the same store of lyrics that appear in Bushalong's Talking Blues. From the tall tale opener, if you want to get to heaven, let me tell you what to do. The theme stretches back to antebellum minstrelsy, where this verse and few others were joined together in a spiritual called Mourner, You Shall Be Free. Just as a mourner referred to in a recent convert awaited baptism, the song just opposes a worldly life with heavenly promise.
The article skips down.
By the 1940s, Woody Guthrie and Leadbelly were trading verses on We Shall Be Free, and in 1962, the song reflected the contemporary themes in Bob Dylan's I Shall Be Free.
When my telephone rang, it would not stop. It's President Kennedy calling me up. He said, my friend Bob, what do we need to make the country grow? I said, my friend John, Bridget Bardot, Anita Ekberg, Sophia Loren, country will grow.
Bob Dylan's references to Brigitte Bardot and President Kennedy extend a process that has long been part of the song's history. And while Dylan's recording marks one of the last versions of Poor Mourner, the Talking Blues has continued to rework it. Chris Buschelong's song, with its rhymed couplets and rhythmic speech, established a pattern by which hundreds of new verses have come to be written. From hot rod races to the perils of the atom bomb, all of these talking blues finally rest on an American heritage of hog eyes and spare ribs, chicken coops and jailhouses, mourners and preachers, or sometimes the only way to survive is to laugh.
United States, come listen to a story that's hard to relate. Takes place in the town where the hot air blows over the lobbies where the filibuster grows. Hardy perennial, evergreen, stinkweed.
Bob Martin, a regular volunteer at TRS, read the part of Stephen Wade in that NPR News interview from 2001. Thank you, Bob. He also was the one who introduced me to this genre of music. So let me ask you, Bob, how were you first introduced to this music?
This, strangely, is one of those things that I can identify exactly. I was living in San Francisco between September of 1962 to September of 1963. My wife and I were home one night, and an old friend of ours from high school, who also happened to be living in San Francisco that year, showed up and said, "Bob, you gotta listen to this." He had an album of John Greenway, and we sat and listened to that for three or four times that night.
Very interesting. Bob, now tell us a little bit about the apparent crossover nature of this music. What do you think the influence of talking blues has had on other forms of music?
Well, later on, Pete Seeger said, and this was about 1941, that two of his compatriots and he sat down and, after having been influenced by Woody Guthrie, wrote the Talking Union songs. He said they started out and they collected everything that was wrong, and then they said they had no conclusion. And after several weeks, Pete Seeger said, they came up with the idea that the answer was simply they had to stick together.
Well, once again, thank you, Bob Martin, for joining us on this music review program from the Triangle Radio Reading Service.
Thank you very much.
Now, if you don't want to spend $10 for a pound of steak, and if you don't want to spend $50 a pound for cake, and if you don't want to spend $20 a pound for greens, $200 for rent, and Lord knows what for beans.
This next article comes to us from the New York Times, May 20th, 2011, Zachary Wolf saying farewell to school with some help from Brahms. The music surrounding graduation festivals at most colleges begins and ends with a weak version of Elgar's famous Pomp and Circumstance March. At the Juilliard School, as you might imagine, things are a bit different. In front of warmly encouraging audience with lots of family members and teachers, on Thursday evening at Alice Tully Hall, James DePriest conducted the Juilliard Orchestra in a commencement concert featuring two sweeping romantic works, neither by Elgar. There was extra poignancy in this year's concert. Juilliard announced in January that Mr. DePriest, who has been the school's director of conducting and orchestral studies since 2004, would be ceding his position in the fall to the New York Philharmonic's music director, Alan Gilbert. But it's good news that Mr. DePriest, an admirable artist, will continue with the orchestra as principal conductor and director emeritus. The article skips down and ends with this. The orchestra captured both the work's expansive chorals and its rhythmic vitality, culminating in a majestic finale. No one seemed to miss Pomp and Circumstance.
Just as the sand made everything round, just as the tar seeps up from the ground.
This next article is a review of the Fleet Foxes, who are playing in the background right now, from their new album, Helplessness Blues. This is from The Week magazine, May 20th, 2011. Robin Pecknold and his band traveled a difficult road to create this triumphant follow-up to their blockbuster debut album, said Larry Fitzmaurice in Pitchfork.com. For evidence, look no further than the bittersweet Lorelei or the angry The Shrine, An Argument. Pecknold's 8-minute dissection of a bitter breakup he endured during the album's drawn-out gestation, the inviting melodies, evocative lyrics, and open-armed harmonizing that catapulted Fleet Foxes into the limelight in 2008 are still evident here. But the mood is darker and more uncertain, adding shade to their gold-hued sound. The album's surface is a dazzling evocation of the early 70s rock Eden, said David Fricke of Rolling Stone. Though Pecknold is too young to remember the era that produced the space cowboy romance of Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, he's found refuge and inspiration in that pop epic, keeping the warm harmonies and shimmering acoustic guitars, but rewriting its love vows to suit an age of reduced expectation.
Tell me again, my only son.
This final article comes to us from Entertainment Weekly, published on May 27, 2011, My Favorite Tour Memory by Adam Levine. We had a van, then a box RV that we lovingly referred to as RV Keitel. When we finally graduated to a real tour bus, our driver's name was Ringo. I'm pretty sure he hated me after I got drunk in Dallas and tried to eat his pet fish, sushi. I was young, Ringo, and I'm sorry about that. So how'd you do on the trivia questions today? First question, who is best known for his three-finger picking of a five-string guitar or banjo? The correct answer is Earl Scruggs, answer B. Scruggs was taught to play the five-string banjo with a three-fingered picking style. He is considered one of the finest banjo players in bluegrass. By the time he was six, he was playing with his brothers. 10 years later, he was playing with the group the Carolina Wildcats. In 1945, he joined Bill Monroe's Bluegrass Boys. Question number two. Not only men are famous in bluegrass, who is the lady that sang I'll Fly Away on the movie soundtrack of Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? The correct answer is Alison Krauss. She's one of the finest fiddlers and vocalists in bluegrass. She also made the album Raising Sand with Led Zeppelin's Robert Plant back in 2007.
Now, I ain't had very much schooling, but you can take it from me, and I ain't fooling. There's some things you learn that ain't in books, like how to get rid of the ugly looks that slums have, and hungry people have, and such like.
Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Rock Review. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Content of this program intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. If you have a suggestion for an artist, group, or genre of rock music to feature on Rock Review, please leave a message for me, Randy Thompson, at 832-5138. So long until next time.
Winning the war and the peace, and fighting disease and poverty. I think us working folks the country over are getting tired of being run over by these business cycles. Hell of a mess. Last one broke my community chest and almost broke my heart. We gotta talk things over and try and choose some schemes to get rid of these post-war blues. I don't think would cause any grief.